The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme,
Oliver St. John Gogarty talked about James Joyce frequenting the Monto.
A history of hidden Dublin. And if there's a piece of history from your area that isn't widely known, text us on 51551. Also,
he was a maniac. He was power hungry. I think in his own way wanted to rule the world.
The Jonestown Massacre, 35 years on. What FBI documents reveal about the deaths of almost 1,000 followers of the Reverend Jim Jones in 1978. And
there wasn't any animosity towards my family, but there was perhaps at that time towards the buildings. Any large buildings were classed as maybe establishment or whatever.
The decline of the great houses of Cork and Kerry. And later, we'll also be finding out why Queen's University historians are going to jail. But let's begin with hearing about some of the hidden and neglected aspects of Dublin's history. And there's a lot of it, according to historians Ariel Glynn and Donal Fallon, who showed Colette Kinsella how much hidden history is in just one small area of O'Connell Street.
When you're standing here looking on either side of the street, it's a classic Dublin cinema that you see. The Savoy on one side and the Carlton on the other. Now, the Carlton is no longer with us, but the Savoy is still open for business. And what I want to talk about here really is Dublin cinemas in the 1920s and the 1930s and how they became a very unlikely battleground for political ideas.
In the mid-1920s, a whole variety of films on the First World War were shown in Irish cinemas.
And unsurprisingly, really, Irish Republicans objected to these films outright.
A documentary about the Battle of Ypres was particularly controversial.
And in 1925, not far from where we're standing, the Masterpiece Cinema was blown up by a Republican landmine and shots were fired at policemen in the pursuit that followed.
The Savoy and Carlton were even sent letter bombs in the 1930s.
And their crime was showing footage of royal weddings. Now, incredibly, I found examples right up to the 1960s of political attacks on Dublin cinemas. Elizabeth as Queen in the 1960s was enough to see gangs of youths run into one Dublin cinema, throw ink on the screen and attempt to rip it down.
But Queen Elizabeth wasn't the only British figure to make waves in Dublin. Nelson's Pillar, which stands where the spire is now, caused its fair share of controversy.
Dubliners are obsessed with Nelson's Pillar, but they're really only interested in two things, its construction and its destruction. In the 1920s, one group campaigned to have the monument of Nelson taken from the pillar and replaced with someone they found more fitting, which was none other than the Virgin Mary herself. In the 1930s, another group of Irish Christians proposed that Nelson be removed from the pillar and in his place, St. Patrick take pride of place on top of the pillar.
But an Irishman who'd made it big in the unions in America had a different idea.
And he said perhaps the recently assassinated John F. Kennedy could take pride of place on top of the pillar. In the end, it wasn't to be Kennedy, St. Patrick, the Virgin Mary or anyone who replaced Nelson, but Nelson himself was sent crashing into the streets in March 1966.
50 years before this, of course, Nelson would have witnessed the 1916 Rising and the battle in the GPO. And in that week, he'd also have seen a lot of things that didn't make it into the history books, like the incredible looting spree that took place.
So what occurred here was huge bands of people going into certain shops around the area of O'Connell Street, of Sackville Street, and they were actually getting things that they could never have, that they could only dream of owning. And it's recorded by Nuala O'Fuaillon, of all people. She talks about how her grandmother saw, I think, oranges for the first time, or ate oranges for the first time during the Rising.
And just a few streets away, a very different type of business was thriving in one of Dublin's most notorious areas.
We're walking down North Earl Street in the direction of Talbot Street. We're going down into what would have been close to the Monto district.
The Monto, which got its name from the old Montgomery Street, was Dublin's infamous red light district.
Which would have been off the side streets of Talbot Street.
From the early 19th century, hundreds of prostitutes plied their trade in the many brothels, or kips, as they were known back then. And the women themselves had a variety of labels.
Such as women of bad character, unfortunate women, destitute women, night walkers, nymphs of the pave and fallen women.
The Monto boasted all manner of clients, including England's Prince Albert, and even members of the Irish literary set.
Oliver St. John Gogarty talked about James Joyce frequenting the Monto, and he wrote a little ditty to Joyce. There is a young fellow named Joyce who possesses a sweet tenor voice. He goes down to the kips with a psalm on his lips, and bid at the harlots rejoice.
Okay, so that's where the term kip came from. That was a new one on me. And the historians in that piece, Ariel Glynn and Donal Fallon of UCD's Adult Education Centre, are here with me to tell us more about Dublin's hidden history and a new course starting this week in UCD on this very topic. And wasn't Dublin's red light district the largest in Europe at one stage, Ariel?
Well, some esteemed visitors who came to the city commented that it was the largest they had seen in Europe compared to a lot of the other cities they had visited.
I can't imagine there was anybody actually taking measurements or doing a census or anything like that, but anecdotally at least it would appear to have been. Oliver St. John Gogarty Donald, before we continue, you came out with something very, very interesting and another little piece of hidden history.
So Oliver St. John Gogarty can boast of having lined up for Bohemians Football Club.
I cannot believe that Oliver St. John Gogarty A was a soccer player and B was good enough to play for Bohemians.
He made it to Bohemians.
Extraordinary. Now, the Irish history traditionally focuses on famous male leaders and major events. But what you're interested in all of this is the kind of stuff that doesn't actually make the history books.
Yeah, Irish history, but we're no different from any other people. I think across the world, there's a trend in history of a sort of a great man theory of always looking at history in the context of great individuals. And you see that at the moment, actually, even in the commemorations of 1913, this epic battle between William Martin Murphy and Jim Larkin. We always bring our history back down to key individuals. But when you get into the great body of the people, the social history, the history of the majority of citizens, there's brilliant, brilliant stories there. Mm. And not only that, it tends to resonate with people more as well. There's a great movement now in Ireland in recent years of social history, history from the bottom up. And I think that's where the real stories are found and what connects with people.
And actually next week on the programme, just in relation to 1913, we're going to be doing some more of those hidden histories, if you like. We're going to be looking at the children of 1913. Now, if you have some hidden history in your area that you want to share with us, text us on 51551. Do you think that, Ariel, there are people listening today, people who might attend this adult education course in UCD, they're actually carrying a lot of history around with them and they don't necessarily even know it. They don't think it's of any particular value.
Definitely. It's incredible the amount of people, Dubliners more generally and people who live in Dublin just seem to have loads of stories about the history of the city. I was in Mullingar working on my other job, which is about emigration and it's a UCC project about emigration. And I was talking to someone who was from the Liberties in Dublin and he was talking about how Lady Guinness used to come to the Baino in the Liberties. So it's the kind of just across from St. Patrick's Cathedral. It's where Liberties VEC is today. And they used to have to sing in front of Lady Guinness to get their bun and cocoa.
You've got loads of examples, I know, of that kind of history that people are carrying around with them. I mean, are you constantly bumping into people and picking their brains?
Yeah, and what's great about that kind of history is that people didn't think this was important. People didn't think their own history or even their own areas were important. But in recent times, I think that's beginning to change. There's been a lot of oral history done in this country in the last couple of years. And we have an oral history network now and everything. And that's really, really important, talking to ordinary people and convincing them. And there is some convincing to do of the importance in their own stories. Groups like the North Inner City Folklore Project, and there's countless other groups around the country. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're convincing people of the value of their own history, and that's important.
Are you surprised at the extent, Ariel, to which people are actually connected to history, that they know somebody, perhaps in their own family, perhaps a neighbour, that they have talked to who may have been born in the 19th century or may have known somebody who was born in the middle of the 19th century or even the early 19th century? You can go back quite a ways, can't you?
Yeah, definitely. I know my father would tell me stories that his grandfather had told him about. They were from Westmeath and they were builders and that they were building walls during the famine.
So your father would tell you stories about his grandfather. So that's your great-grandfather, in other words.
Yep.
So how far back does that bring you?
So that's to the famine period.
To the famine,
so
okay.
That's oral history.
How far back can you go, Donald?
Well, you can do just every family can do just the same. But talking about these periods in history that we think are totally disconnected, William Martin Murphy, whose name we keep hearing now in connection with the lockout, he was born in the year the famine began, in 1845. What we think is being massively distant and separate events in history,
are not as distant as we think. And in interviewing people today, we can still talk to people whose families were directly connected and involved with major, major events.
OK, pick one tiny area of the city of Dublin. I mean, we heard on Colette's report with you, O'Connell Street. Pick another area of Dublin and tell us some of the stories that perhaps we don't know.
Well, you know, as part of this course, we're going to be going on walks around the city. And our first walk next weekend will be in Portobello. And even if you were just to stand on around Portobello Bridge, you have a huge amount of history all around you. If you look towards Rathmines Church, for example, the beautiful dome on the church was meant to be destined for St. Petersburg. But because of the Russian Revolution taking place in 1917, the dome was sent to Rathmines instead because there was no takers for it in Russia because the state was now communist and religion.
Did they then, presumably, they must have built the church around the dome rather than the other way around? They didn't just sort of arbitrarily, oh, there's a dome available, we can stick it on top of the church.
There had been actually a big fire in Rathmines Church around that period around 1920.
And okay, that's looking down Rathmines Road. If you're looking back in towards the city, or you're looking, if you're standing on Portobello Bridge, you're looking on the canal, for example. What else happened in that immediate vicinity? By the way, 51551 for your text. If you've got any particular stories about your own area, your own part of Dublin.
So even the bridge itself, in April 1861, there was an accident whereby a horse-drawn bus fell into the canal. And all the people in the actual bus lost their lives. And as a result of that, because it was quite a steep bridge, as a result of that thereafter, people used to stop and get out from the horse-drawn buses and let the horses go over the bridge without people. And then they'd walk over.
Get back in on the far side.
Yeah.
That kind of thing could happen. A bus could actually topple over a bridge and go into the canal and everybody's lost. Quite extraordinary. The overcrowded tenements. I mean, you were talking there again in the package with Colette about a part of Dublin which was overcrowded. Why did we have the kind of death rates in the early 20th century, which were similar to Calcutta, for example?
I think that's the most shocking fact in Dublin's history, that at one stage this city could rival Calcutta on infant mortality rates. You know, at the time of the 1913 lockout, over 20,000 families in Dublin were living in one-room dwellings. Dublin was unusual in that every major city in Europe had slums. Now, in most cities, they were the product of the Industrial Revolution. In Dublin, they're quite the opposite. They're the product of deindustrialisation. You know, the people are living in palatial slums. They're living in what had been the houses of the rich. But you have homes which were built for one family to enjoy in the 18th century, which are now home to maybe 10 or 12 families. Sanitary conditions are totally unfit. The houses aren't fit for human habitation. Charles Cameron, who's the chief medical officer in Dublin at the time, one thing he really goes after is the milk that children are drinking is unfit for human consumption. The Dublin of the early 20th century is a breeding ground for disease. You have, we talk about the homes of the working class, that are homes of an underclass. And most people in Dublin are working when they can get work. They're casual labourers. There's no money. There's people living in poverty we can't even imagine today. James Connolly famously said, you know, Ireland is a country of wonderful charity and singularly little justice. And he said the slums of Dublin were unlike anything anywhere else in the world.
Some of the texts that have come in. My great-grandfather was born in 1847. His daughter, my grandmother, died in 1991. That's from Jim Duffy. So that's somebody who goes back a heck of a way with 3 degrees of separation or thereabouts. Irish Sailors and Soldiers Land Trust Fusiliers 1914 to 1918. The Veterans Ivy Trust Survivors of the Great War. I'm not quite sure what that is about or what that is supposed to be about. Does Donald know about the hammam Turkish baths which flourished in O'Connell Street from the late 19th century into the 1930s?
You're I don't know. No, and they will be examined on Come Here to Me in time. They're on the long list of things to explore, but they don't feature in the course.
But obviously something you can do a little bit of research on and perhaps include it in a future course. Can you give out the name of the course in Hidden History in UCD, says Dara? So, okay, well, give us that now. I was going to ask you that at the end, but you might as well tell us now.
So it's called The Hidden History of Dublin from Monto to Little Jerusalem. And you can get it, a link to it on the adult education website of UCD, and you can actually enrol online or else ring them.
And there are details also on our website, so you can go to rte.ie/thehistoryshow and you can get details there. Little Jerusalem, where was that and what was that?
That was quite close to Portobello, the same area that we were discussing previously. It was an area that was inhabited by Dublin's Jewish community. So a lot of people think of Ireland today as being quite multicultural, full of immigrants, and they think it's unprecedented, but it wasn't. Back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, Dublin was very much an international city. So you had a lot of Jewish people coming from Lithuania, you had Germans coming in, you had Italians coming in, and close by in Portobello, in what would have been Little Jerusalem, on Leonard's Corner, there was a butcher's, George Ritzel's pork butcher's, a German butcher's that was attacked in 1915 by people belonging to the Redmondite Volunteers, because they felt that, you know, that the Germans, these German butchers represented the Germans in the First World War.
And these people coming from, as you say, different parts of Europe, would they have had a common language? Would they have spoken Yiddish to each other? Or would they have been as difficult for each other to understand as they would have been for the natives, for Dublin people to understand?
The people coming from Lithuania and Ukraine, they would have spoken Yiddish to each other, but there actually was quite a large Jewish community previously in Dublin and Ireland, and that was quite wealthy, and they looked down upon these later Jewish immigrants to Dublin because they were seen to be quite poor and bringing their name down.
Famously on Yiddish, you know, James Connolly produced the only election leaflet in Irish history, which was in the Yiddish language. When he was standing in the Wood Quay ward, and that's something we'll be looking at in the course as well.
James Connolly had an actual document. He published a document.
He produced an election leaflet specifically in Yiddish. Now it didn't do much good. He wasn't elected in the elections he stood in.
Okay. Somebody texted to say my late godmother told me she'd been to Parnell's funeral at 5 years of age. So that would have been in 1891. Despite my late mother's encouragement, I unfortunately never interviewed her. I didn't want to be intrusive. Well, that's a lesson. Yeah. Basically, if you've got anybody in your family who's got anything interesting to say, get it on tape.
How much the world has changed. Someone saying that a relative who died in 1991, born in 1847, we could talk all the way back to 1847. Nowadays, dictaphones and recording devices are so easy to come across, and getting these stories down is easier than it's ever been. And thankfully, as I say, those local history groups are growing and growing these days. It's great to see.
It is so easy to download apps onto a smartphone now, which will allow you to record anything and everything you want. Owen Ryan says, a man digging his garden in Donnybrook in the 1750s unearthed skeletal remains. They later discovered the remains were 500 bodies from a Viking massacre. The remains were reburied in a graveyard near the Garda station, and Donnybrook Church was built on the site. I have a good story based on word of mouth accounts by my mother, born in 1911, and my grandmother, born in 1889. This is a website, www.o'rourkeundle. O-R-O-U-R-K-E-R-U-N-D-L-E.com. You may want to have a look at that. You may not want to have a look at that. You talked about the tenements and the centre of Dublin and the area around O'Connell Street as being at one point the houses that had belonged to the rich. Essentially, what happened to Dublin after the Act of Union is very interesting, isn't it? And that particular area.
Look, you could begin a course on Dublin's hidden history with Sitrick Silkenbeard. You could begin before that, but we made a decision that we were going to begin with the 18th century because I think what makes the shocking, most of the class actually centres in the late 19th, early 20th century. But I think what makes the poverty of that period all the more shocking is contrasting it with the Dublin of the 18th century. One of the worst lies in Irish history, which is spread, when we talk about the 1916 Rising, we always say, God, I can't believe there was an armed rebellion in the second city of the British Empire. Dublin was not the second city of the British Empire by 1916. But in the 18th century, it was. Mm. And we begin this course by looking at an incredible city, a city of great wealth, a city which in many ways is a training ground for leading architects from across the world, a proud city of empire.
But a city which in sometime towards the end of the 19th century had actually been overtaken in population terms by Belfast.
A city which had gone from a city of the rich to a city which the rich had vacated. And that's what's interesting. That's why we begin with the 18th century.
For, Henrietta Street represents what happened in Dublin in many respects. At the end of the at the end of the 18th century, it was full of viscounts, brigadier generals, archbishops, MPs, and then 100 years later, it's home to 835 people in only 14 houses. And you have huge numbers living in these tenement one-room buildings that have been converted from the late 19th century on into tenements. And you have piggeries in the back, you have just incredible things taking place. You see it. You also see the divide in Dublin, in that in one house on Henrietta Street, you have a family there, just one family and a couple of servants. But then in a house a couple of doors down, you have 108 people and 19 families.
Well, somebody asks here, has there been any commemoration for those who lost their lives in the collapse of houses in Church Street in 1930? And that was Dublin's darkest days. That was a very, very famous instance.
Yeah, the 2nd of September 1913, a massive event in the context of the lockout, which really should be commemorated and which highlighted the shocking housing conditions in the Dublin of the time.
Marie in Dublin says, I was born in 1958. We lived in a tenement house and moved out in 1984. So it's not such an old thing after all. Donal, Guinness is also used in this course as a study of employment in the city. What kind of things did you discover there?
Guinness is a funny one because when Dubliners think of Guinness, and in my own case, my grandfather worked in Guinness. Most Dubliners have a connection to Guinness. And Guinness are very fondly remembered as someone would say, a perfect employer. And yet it was an employer who politically would have been at odds for many Irish people. A company who would have been staunchly loyalist in the 18th century. And in the early 20th century, it would have been hostile to trade unionism. We look at the conflict between Larkin and the Guinness Brewery, and we look at the of Guinness as an employer and what they meant to the area. Guinness are a great, great case study.
And so somebody points out, Michael Clark points out, that William Martin Murphy was, of course, the first president of the Rathmines and Rathgar Musical Society, which was founded in the same year as the lockout. In fact, it was founded in this month, and his son was the third president and his daughter was the fourth president. There's a little bit of trivia for you. Anyway.
A nationalist himself, he turned down a knighthood and everything.
Indeed he did, back in 1907. Okay, thank you very much, both of you. It sounds like a fascinating course. It's a three-week course at UCD, A History of Hidden Dublin. It starts this coming Wednesdays and Thursdays, two lectures a week.
Wednesdays and Saturdays,
I beg your pardon. Wednesdays and Saturdays, two lectures a week for the next 3 weeks. Ariel Glynn and Donal Fallon of UCD's Adult Education Centre, thanks for joining us. And as I say, full details are on our website, history@rte.ie. Back after this break with the Jones.